Thank you, Dave. My name's Rachel. I'm an alcoholic. I should say I'm a little bit nervous because I am, and sometimes it helps just to say that. But I'm really, really glad to be here, and I'm really glad to be able to carry the message. I'm glad to be here tonight, and I'm really glad to be in this program. It's just really, I thought it was a death sentence when I first found my way. I thought my life was over because I was too young. And then I found that it was really everything I was ever looking for in my life, in the bottle, in, you know, self-help books. I mean, it just was all found in the ruins, for me, at least. And my sobriety date is April 1st of 99. And I think about why that day was so different than the many other times when I look back that I see that God was really trying to place me under his care. You know, what was different about April 1st, 1999? And I think that it was just that moment that I was really open to accepting that, you know, something came between me and the booze, and I was literally plucked from that life, placed into the rooms of AA, and I just kind of stuck around. I don't know how that happened initially. I don't know why I didn't want to be here. I was here really to get a lot of people off my back. I was facing criminal charges, losing my job. My family had had enough of me, and I kind of thought I'd come around for a little bit to get people off my back. But something happened, you know, that magic that happened that kept me coming, and I'm still here. And I'm really grateful for that. And tonight I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope relating to there is a solution in the big book. And it's been kind of neat thinking about when I first was introduced to this, you know, thinking about it through the eyes of the newcomer. And it was really, really powerful for me when I was introduced to the big book, which didn't happen on April 1st of 99. It happened probably November, November of 99 when, you know, I had had one. It was sitting around my house, and I would go to meetings where they would read little bits and pieces from it, but that was really it. I'd never picked it up and studied it. So I'm thinking about what that meant at that time and how that really, really was just an unbelievable experience for me. And it's been neat over the last couple of weeks reflecting on that and bringing it back to that hope that I felt, you know, when I opened up this book. I just want to briefly share a little bit about what brought me into AA, you know, because it certainly wasn't because I had my life together and I knew how to do relationships and, you know, I was successful and stable emotionally. It was none of the above. I truly believe I was born an alcoholic simply because I had that physical allergy that the doctor's opinion talks about. But what my younger years were like was a lot of really trying not to end up as an alcoholic because it was in my family, and my father drank and he identifies himself as an alcoholic, and he hasn't had a drink in, it's 15 years this month. So I was 15 years old when he found his way to the rooms. And so growing up in the chaos of the alcoholic family, and as a little kid, alcohol pretty much touched every aspect of my life. The really tragic times, but the really good times too. You know, it was kind of a constant. And while the status of my father's emotional and spiritual condition was definitely not a constant. Sometimes he was greatest in the greatest mood ever, and then other times it was really, really scary. Alcohol was always there. My dad liked to drink in bars, and he liked to bring myself and my sister along. I have a twin sister, and, you know, people would call us the bookends. And I'd sit there with my first cocktail ever, which was a Shirley Temple, you know, extra cherries, sit at the bar. And I became very, very comfortable in that place very, very early. And I loved all of the excitement in the bar and the laughter. To me, it just seemed like a lot of laughter was going on. But I also remember the really late nights. Like sitting there wondering when are we going to go home? You know, when is it time to go home? And very powerful memory for me was it was the night before Easter, and we were out. My dad liked to bring us all out to dinner, and then we would kind of sit at the table while he drank at the bar with his buddies. So it was the night before Easter, and we were out, and he was doing his thing. And I remember looking out the window thinking, the Easter Bunny's going to miss us because we're going to be here, you know, and the Easter Bunny's not going to get there. And you know, so that was pretty scary. But I don't blame my alcoholism on any of that stuff. But I certainly, things started to change. The way that I viewed the world certainly started to change, probably around, nine, 10 years old. And I really believe that I was born with, I loved God when I was young. I mean, I loved it. I loved the religious aspect of it. I loved the spiritual aspect of it. I had this wonderful relationship with God, which is just the easiest way for me to say my higher power as I understand him. I just use God because it's kind of short and sweet, and it's a word that's familiar for me. So don't get too hung up on that if it's something else. I mean, there's a reason why the big book tells us it's our own conception of the higher power. But I just remember having that really great relationship as a little kid, you know, and I went to Catholic school and I loved it. Until like seventh grade. But I loved it, you know. I loved Catholic school. And I got made fun of a lot, too, because of my relationship with the God of my understanding at that time. But then all that stuff started happening. I was this depressed kid. I was always sad. Very, very negative. And the reason why I share this is because I realized that I had like symptoms of this spiritual disease before I even picked up alcohol. You know, before... the drinking and the turmoil kind of created that hole to just get bigger and bigger and bigger. As a little kid, I already was experiencing that stuff that it talks about later in the book. And my parents tried every solution imaginable. They sent me to therapists. I was put on medication. They sent me away, you know, inpatient. And I was a pretty messed up kid, you know. And I just remember being very, very sad a lot of the time. And just wanting to figure out what was wrong with me and to feel better. I just wanted to feel better. And in the midst of this, you know, I decided that I didn't want to drink because I didn't want to be an alcoholic like my dad. And I found some peace in that, and I found a group of people that really believed in that. And we were like the high on life kids that you always hated in high school. You know, that was us. And I was happy, and I had a great group of friends. And then it just wasn't enough, you know, just that insecurity and the feeling like I wasn't good enough. And I decided, like, I want to be cool. And I found this group of people that I thought was cool, and I just kind of weaseled my way in, and in came alcohol. And I instantly fell in love with the effects, and I instantly fell in love with the illusion of friendship and socialization, and all my insecurities just melted away. I was a very heavy teenager, and you know, while I hear a lot of people share that they felt like you know, no one noticed them, I kind of felt like I was larger than life, and everywhere I went, I was bumping into things, and people noticed that, and I just wanted to disappear. So alcohol really helped me do that. Interestingly, the opposite effect in terms of my personality. I was pretty loud to begin with, and alcohol just really, really magnified that, and I was. Probably the loud, obnoxious, you know, drunk girl. That was a lot of fun, too. You know, it was definitely fun in the beginning. But what's true for me is that from that very first taste of alcohol, after I had that one taste, something happened that made it absolutely impossible for me to stop. And I didn't know what that was. And you know, the doctor's opinion explains that to us. And I remember reading that and saying, oh, I'm allergic to alcohol. That's why. You know, that's why I plan on just going for two or three. And next thing I know, it's 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm looking in the mirror thinking, who are you? Like, I hate you. Who have you become, you know? And I never said I'm just going to have one. I learned very early that one didn't do it for me. You know, I wanted two or three. You know, I wanted to feel that buzz. And so I chased the illusion of I'll just go for two or three. And that just never was the case. I tried very hard to do two or three, you know, and it just didn't happen. Bad things happen, consequences for me with my drinking. And you know, you don't have to have a lot of horrible, bad things. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the qualification for an alcoholic is when you start drinking, does something start to happen that makes it impossible for you to stop? I mean, it explains that to us more in depth after this chapter, but really bad things happened to me very early on. When I came in the rooms, I heard a lot of times I spilled more beer on my tie than you probably drank. And my favorite was one guy that said, I drank more in 1 week than you drank, you know, the whole time you were out there. And I was like, well, it must have been a pretty busy week, you know, because I was hitting it pretty hard. But from, like, when I was 18, I had my first car accident, you know, to follow by 7 other drunk driving car accidents after that time, till the time I came into the room. And I never once got a DUI. I never once had any consequences except for damaged vehicles, you know, and I'm grateful that I did no harm to other people. I did total a car one time that wasn't mine, and a hit and run another time. And I've heard people in these rooms share that as a result of their drinking, their actions led to the death of someone and car accidents and different things. And what's amazing about this program is it's okay, you know, and there's a way to work through that and get past that. And that's pretty amazing, because where else in the universe can you just be accepted unconditionally like we are in the rooms of AA? But just car accidents, blackouts, broken bones, I envisioned myself this classy woman, you know, like I'd be sitting on the bar stool with my highball, whatever the heck that was, it just sounded good, you know, my highball. And there was nothing classy about me, you know. I was a fall-down, blackout, horrible things kind of drunk. And I did have this ability to gracefully slide off of bar stools. It was just something weird. I'd be sitting there 1 minute, and then the next minute, I'd just kind of gracefully slide to the ground. But that was really about it, you know. I think about that and how one day, like when I slid off that bar stool, I looked up and like AA was there to pick me up, you know, and that's pretty cool. Everybody around me told me I had a problem, of course, you know. I started to think maybe something was wrong, but I was convinced that if I got this depression thing under control, I'd be okay. And if I got this weight thing under control, I'd be okay. And maybe if I found a really good boyfriend, I'd be okay, you know. Someone that treated me the way I really deserved to be treated because of the life that I had. You know, I was picking these guys that had nothing to offer me. And the truth was I was just sucking the life out of everybody and everything. You know, the booze and the relationships and just the manipulation and just trying to get something to make me feel okay. Just give me something to fill up this hole, you know. And I didn't realize any of this at the time. This has come over the course of working the steps, you know, that I just had this like black hole that existed in my soul before I even picked up the drink, and drinking and booze really twisted that and turned that, and it was like a black hole that sucked away whatever was in front of it. And for me, my truth is it was fueled by insecurity and fear and feeling like I wasn't good enough and, you know, all of this stuff. What I learned to be my defects of character. And the really cool thing about this program is that, like, there is a solution. I mean, there is a way that we get past that. And I've experienced amazing, amazing change and miracles in terms of some of that stuff. And I'm unrecognizable to myself, and that's scary sometimes, but it's really cool other times, because I didn't like me. You know, I definitely didn't like me. I was dropped in the rooms of AA a couple of different times in those years, and I would just kind of pop in, stick around for like a day, and then be back out at the bar. You know, I just didn't get it. I just didn't hear it. And I think I thought, well, now that I know I have a problem, I can just moderate. You know, I'll try and watch other people that seem to be able to leave the bar early. And I couldn't do that. I absolutely could not do that, because I'm an alcoholic and I have a physical allergy and it compels me to go on drinking. And eventually, on a night that was definitely not my worst drunk. It was not my worst drunk. But I got pulled over, you know, crossing double yellows, and that was the moment when grace just kind of filtered into my life, and I said, okay, all right, again, my motive was to get everybody off my back, but it got me here. My sponsor says God gets our attention in ways that mean something to us. And at the time, it was like, I need to get everybody off my back, and I ended up here. And I originally got sober in meetings God got me sober, but I went to meetings in Sussex County, and there was a lot of, it's kind of like you didn't just have a home group, like all of the Sussex County meetings was like home group, you know, because it was so small. And I heard a lot of the wisdom of the meetings, and I saw a lot of happy people. I didn't necessarily come into contact with a lot of women that said to me, hey, come on, like, you know, I want to help you. I also recognized that at the time I wanted nothing to do with the women, you know, because I never knew what that was about. And I felt validated and more secure kind of talking to the guys. And I'm very, very lucky that there were no men in my home group with ill motives, and they really tried to steer me towards, you know, people that would be helpful for me and carry the message and not a whole lot more than that. So that was a blessing. There's this great article that was first printed in the Grapevine in 1974 called Give the Girl a Chance. It's on their website. If you go there, read it. It's just awesome. It talks about how you see the newcomer woman coming in, like me, you know, I was, and laughing and flirty and wanting nothing to do with the women. And it's because we're looking for love, you know, and where better to find that solution than in the book. And so I find that it's very important for me to approach a newcomer woman, whether she wants me to be around her or not, and I just make myself available. You know, I don't try to necessarily grab her and pull her away because I don't want to kind of ruin that potential relationship, but I continue to make myself available and make sure that I say hello when I see a new face, because I didn't get a whole lot of hellos when I was new, you know, from the women, and I think that's really important that we do that. So I floated around the rooms, and, you know, I was feeling good. I was feeling the hope of steps 1, 2, and 3, the hope of the A, B, and C and how it works, you know. Admitted we're alcoholic. No human power could relieve our alcoholism, and God couldn't would if he were sought. I was like, yeah, this is great. I know where my car is. I'm not hungover anymore. You know, this is awesome. And I was like the pink cloud newcomer where I'd be like, sobriety is so great. And then what started to happen was sobriety wasn't so great anymore. And I was doing things at 5 months sober that I don't ever remember doing when I was drunk. I was acting out. I was in a very chaotic relationship at the time with someone who remained, well, kept trying to get it after I got sober, but pretty much stayed active. And I was just doing crazy things. I was lashing out physically, just like I said, stuff that it was never me when I was drinking. And it was like, whoa, I mean, this is horrible. This was supposed to be good, and look what's going on. And the truth was that I was just an open wound, you know. I had all this stuff coming to the surface. And people are telling me, you'll find these tools to use to work through this stuff. And I'm like, well, where are these tools you guys keep talking about? I mean, they're not just like showing up in my front door when I come home from work. I really was confused, and I remember at 5 months surrendering to the fact that, you know what, I might never drink again. I'm going to be one of those dry drunks, though. You know, I had a couple dry drunks in my life, and I just kind of figured, like, all right, that'll be me. That'll be me. You know, I don't know what else to do. And in the meantime, I had dumped my sponsor that took me through the first 90 days with wisdom like, if you got one foot in yesterday and the other foot in tomorrow, you're pissing on the day, dear. You're just pissing on the day. And it worked, you know, for 90 days. And the don't drink and go to meetings, which got me, you know, going back to meetings. But like I said, that hope that I felt when I first came in, I wasn't feeling it anymore. I really wasn't. And I lied when I went to the meetings, like, I'm okay, I'm great, this is great. And I was going away on a business trip. And it was my first time since I got sober. I was 6 months sober. And in hindsight, I was about to pick up a drink. And what happened was one of those amazing slam on the head, billboard flashing signs like, God wants you to be sober. God wants to work in your life kind of moments. You know, I had a lot of those. It's really cool. Those powerful, powerful moments. And I'd spoken at a rehab on a Tuesday night and lied through my teeth about how wonderful this was and telling these people how to get sober when I didn't even know how to, like, have normal conversations with people, you know. And I go to get on this plane at Newark Airport, and there's this kid standing by the gate a week later, pointing to me like, "You smoke at Sunrise House." And I just looked at this kid like, "Oh my gosh." And someone said to me, "He really needed you in that moment." And I said, "It had nothing to do with this kid needing me. Like, I needed this kid, you know?" And something just sparked in me, and I went on this trip, and I went to AA meetings, and I decided that I needed to find a sponsor, and I needed to do something. And this woman had given me a couple of phone numbers for my friend, because I was trying to find a good sponsor for my friend. And I really did. I had this friend. We came in together, and I was worried because she didn't have a sponsor. So I hear a woman that, like, I'd identify with for this other woman. Like, wow, my friend would really identify with you. Can I have your number so I can give it to her? And meanwhile, I was just doing my own thing. And there was one number that this woman had given me for my friend, and I just looked at it and called. I mean, just talk about blind faith. Like, I'm just going to call this person. And she lived about 45 minutes away from me, and she told me, "This is what you need to do. You got to come here, and we're going to read through this big book, and I'm going to take you through the steps, and you're going to hear some stuff that you don't hear in meetings, and that, you know, that's okay, but come on over. When do you want to start?" And I was like, "Let's start tomorrow night." And I would drive to her house at 10 o'clock at night. It was an hour, you know, 45 minutes to an hour drive, and we'd read the book for an hour, and I'd drive home, and oh, I felt this peace when this book opened up, and she would say the set-aside prayer, and it was just, I was a little weird about praying with other people at first, but now I love it. Like, I'm the one that says, "Let's pray. You want to pray? You know, let's say the set-aside prayer." And it was just amazing to be introduced to this book and to learn, as Cass touched on, the doctor's opinion that I had this allergy to alcohol, this phenomenon of craving that only existed when I introduced it into my body. Hello, you know, that's why I couldn't just have one, you know, okay, I'm starting to get that. And then Bill's story identified the disease, and I could identify with the progression and the insanity, and I wasn't a stockbroker, you know, I wasn't a man, you know, I didn't, like, lose a lot of the stuff that Bill lost, but I was really open, and I could identify with those things in my life, the progression and the losses and trying to figure out how to make it better and just not knowing how to make it better. And I love when Ebby comes into Bill's story. You know, you hear people share in meetings like, "Thank God for Bill and Dr. Bob." And I'm always like, "What about Ebby?" You know, "What about Ebby?" Ebby's just, he carried that message, you know, when he was really just kind of doing it in this new way. And he carried the message to Bill. And I really love that. Props to Ebby. You know, he's a really great guy. And I know we had it rough and all that stuff, but I had started a woman's big book study in my apartment about a year and a half ago before I moved, and we called ourselves Ebby's Girls, so, you know. That's my little tribute to Ebby. But anyway, it was like, here it was. This person was coming to him and saying, "Yeah, you know, you're trying this stuff, but here's a way that I got out of it. You know, I've been the same place you've been, you know, and in the rooms we share our experience, strength, and hope." And that was really cool. So then I get to, like, the chapter, we get to There Is a Solution. And I remember really getting hooked into this. This is awesome. This is cool. Like, there's something happening that I haven't been able to do on my own. And I was really, really ready. And there is a solution, right? Hope. Remember, I had found that hope, and then I lost it again. And then I read this title of this chapter, and it's like, there it is again. That's that hope that I really felt very strongly initially, and I want to feel again. And there it was, you know, in black and white. So what I was told was that this chapter, the first part talked a lot about the physical part of our addiction, building more on what the doctor's opinion said, that we just have this physical allergy, you know, and we can't stop once we start. And, okay, so now that I got that, because I did get that, so somehow I got that. My sponsor had suggested that I just think of one night when things got really bad, and I thought of a night that I had a hit and run, and that hit and run was in, like, May of 1998, so about 11 months before I came in what I hoped to be the last time. And she took me through that day. What'd you do? How much did you drink? What happened? The evening ended in a blackout, and I had a hit-and-run car accident. I hit a parked car and just drove on home, you know? And then what she said to me was, "Okay, now how many times did you do that again after that night?" And I was like, whoa, 11 months. It had to have been at least
300 times. I mean, it really drove it home to me. So I got that, and then it was like, all right, so what? Then I can just stop, you know, but I wasn't able to do that in the past. So the second half of the chapter talks about the mental obsession, right? The reason why I can't stop, just knowing that once I drink alcohol, something's going to happen and all that craziness is going to come back. And I love that it said nearly all have recovered. And I remember her pointing that out to me, my first sponsor who took me through the big book, recovered, you know. And I'm like, great, so I can just kind of pick up, do this deal, and just be on with my life, you know. And I was reminded, no, that's just, you got to keep coming and doing the deal. In Minnesota, they say doing the deal. I was in Minnesota for about 10 months. Doing the deal and working the steps and being of service and contingent upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition. So I'm not like totally cured, you know. It's going to be there looming, ever present, you know, but I'm going to have these tools now that I'm going to be like recovered from that stuff. And that was an awesome promise. I think about, they talk about the fellowship, like we come to this place and there's all these different people and we feel so welcome, and there's this feeling like, you know, like people who have escaped, you know, the shipwreck. And at one of my home group meetings, there was this guy with all kinds of tattoos and shaved hair and piercings and stuff. And one night he was sitting next to this little old lady who was about 80 years old, you know. And I was like, this is just amazing, you know. I mean, it's just really, really cool. And I think that especially as a woman, you know, when finally I was able to let women into my life, I think about the fact that I wanted, you know, I had some female friends when I was active, but I didn't trust you. I was trying to steal your man. You know, I was just, it was constant competition. You were prettier than me, smarter than me, maybe you had more money, you were thinner. There was always that competition. So, you know, and I didn't necessarily let go of that when I first came in. You know, we can be just so, you know, gossip hounds. It brings us closer together, right? The person I'm gossiping to about the other person, it brings me and her a little closer together. And that can get pretty damaging. But I think about that with the support of women that I have now in my life. And I certainly wouldn't have been friends with them when I was out there. I would have hated half of them, you know. So that's really neat. And it does say, like, okay, so we can get off this shipwreck boat and go on our merry ways. But I think about the people that got, like, wounded in that shipwreck, you know. What about the guy with the broken arm? And what about the person with that emotional trauma? Like, what did they do, you know? And that was like me with my alcoholism. Yeah, I was so excited that I was here, but I had this broken arm and this, like, you know, shattered heart, and what am I going to do about that? And that's where the steps come in. And so that's that half common peril. We're all alcoholics, but the important part for me is that solution. Like, we're drawn together by that solution. And that's another wonderful promise. You know, they say that they wrote this book, the first like 100 or so, and they say that we have a way out on which we can absolutely agree, And I'm like, all right, if they were anything like me, you know, I mean, how did they really agree on that? And the only thing I can think of is that this was so God-inspired. It was so higher-powered, kind of like, you know, that tradition, that one ultimate authority, a loving God, and it expressed itself in this book. And that's really neat. Goes on to talk about the illness, you know, to hear myself described as someone with an illness. Now, I could have run with that and said, feel sorry for me, I had this illness, you know, but instead it really helped me understand what was going on with me. And but the difference is that someone with an illness such as cancer or MS, I mean, people feel sorry for them, you know, and us, I mean, we destroy the lives of other people with this illness, you know, ourselves, other people. And on page 18, it talks about it engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. You know, I think about how I was one of those blameless children with warped lives, but that would be taking my dad's inventory, you know, instead of mine. And, you know, but for the grace of God, I have no children. So I had children in my life, and my drinking affected them in very, very powerful ways. And I did things that I never thought I would do. And Cass shared very honestly and courageously last week about what her addiction did to her and her relationship. And I've shared a lot of women. I've heard a lot of women share that, you know, that it really stripped away any desire to be a loving mother, you know. And this program teaches us how to become better people and become more of what God wants us to be. And there are no new sins, you know. The chances are someone in here has done something you've done or felt the way you felt, and we just have to share it to get to that place. That three quarters of the way down that page, it talks about the italics. I love my first sponsor said italics. When I say my first sponsor, I mean the first sponsor that took me through the steps. She wasn't actually my first sponsor, but italics, that means pay attention. And it talks about that people come into our lives and try to tell us what to do. You need to stop drinking, or you need to control your alcohol consumption. And they lecture us, and why can't you just stop drinking for me? And it means nothing. But then we come into the rooms, or we're introduced to another fellow sufferer, and it just takes on a whole new light. You know, they're not pointing the finger at us. What they're doing is pointing the finger at them and saying, you know, what I share is my experience. Like, this is what it was like. You know, I drank, I got drunk, horrible things happened, I felt horrible, I was depressed and anxious, and this is what happened. You know, I hit a bottom, and I just needed a way out, and I found AA, and I found the 12 steps, and my life's amazing now, you know. And then it's like, wow, all right, if I can identify with what it was like, you know, maybe I can be to where he is now or she is now. And that's kind of some guidelines like for 12-step work. You know, we don't point the finger or lecture. We just share our experience, strength, and hope. And we just leave the results up to God. You know, we plant the seed and you let God water it kind of thing, you know. On page 19, it talks about the much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. I remember hearing someone say, if you want to show someone your sobriety, let them into your life. And I think that's really true, because I know that I went to meetings for like that first year talking this talk, you know, woohoo, AA, recovery, God is good. And then I was going home and doing crazy, crazy things to myself and other people. That was certainly not the mark of a sober woman, you know, with dignity and grace. I mean, it was just, none of that was good. So I think it's important for me now to let people into my life, too. Because my life is very much different than it was, thanks to, you know, the solution, this hope. So they talk about what the book is here to just kind of show people what to do, the solution, the steps, the answer to the problem being drinking, and the answer being recovery. And it's been true for me over and over again with anything in my life. You know, coming from the perspective of when I first came in, it was that hope that I could stop drinking again. I never had to feel that stuff ever again if I just did what it said in here. The paragraph before, it talks about the anonymous volume, page 19.2. Towards the end, it says, many could recover if they had the opportunity we have enjoyed. Like, I forget that sometimes, that this is an opportunity, that there are so many damaged and beaten and just destroyed by this illness, by alcoholism, and we get this opportunity to be introduced to this, you know, and that's really cool. And again, I'm so glad that I just kind of held on to that gift and said, yeah, I'm going to take it, I'm going to do what I have to do to keep it. And then we have to give away what's been so freely given us, or else none of us would be here. You know, that's pretty simple, but I have to be reminded of that, you know, when I want to stay home and not go to a meeting because, like American Idol's on or something, you know. I got to be there and give what's been given to me. The bottom of page 19, most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. I have to remember that, you know. I really have to remember that when I'm in meetings, when people are kind of sharing a lot of the problem and not necessarily the solution. Like, I gotta, you know, my sponsor always says, you know, just share, you know, just to be open and keep yourself available. And I share my current experience, and you know, I don't tell them what they're doing wrong. I just share what worked for me. If they're attracted to that, you know, come on, I'll show you some more. I think that's really important, especially where the parts I come from, and it's just, there's a real resistance to some of the literature, the work of the literature, you know. There's a real resistance to it, and you can very easily get cast aside by the contempt prior to investigation, which it talks about in the the spiritual experience, the appendix two. What's cool is that there was a group of people introduced to a back to basics study from my area. A couple of guys came along, and a couple of them are carrying the message in a really powerful way. And it's amazing to see. There was a couple guys celebrating 90 days the other night at a meeting. Both of them were just about getting ready to do their fifth step. And you see people going, oh, 90 days, that's too soon. You're pushing them too hard. Ease up, a step a year. And then there's, like, you know, the other guys who are kind of like, yeah, you know. And a woman that I have in the rooms, she was sharing with me recently, like, could you imagine if it was a step a year? I was sharing this with someone earlier. A step a year? Like, the stuff swirling around in my head, I need to do a 10th step at the end of the night to quiet my mind. If I waited 10 years to do a 10th step, you know, I certainly wouldn't have been here. I wouldn't have been here after the first year. I really believe that, had I not been introduced to this stuff and someone told me, do it now. Do it now. So that's really exciting. You know, it goes on page 20 to talk about more of that physical stuff. You know, first it says, all right, now we get it. Now we get it. You guys have recovered. I don't know how. So what do I have to do? You know, and I was ready for that. What do I have to do? Show me. I'll do anything. I will do anything. And again, that the 1, 2, and 3 took me so hard. Hope took me so far, and that hope ran out. I needed something more. There is a solution. There was that reignition, you know, that spark again. And now specific instructions as to how I'm going to be able to do that. How many times have people said to us, I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? You know, why don't you just drink like a lady or quit? My favorite was a friend of mine who said, you know what, Rach, you just have to lay off the shots. Lay off the shots and you'll be okay. So I tried it. I really tried it. And I had remembered hearing that the liver processes a shot an hour. So I figured 1 an hour, you know, that'll be laying off. Of course, I wasn't going to not do it at all, but lay off 1 an hour. And I remember I took that first shot of the night, bam, and I was a double, because I always did a double shot first. Like, I had to get there, you know. And then I thought, an hour till the next one. And before I knew it, I'm like looking at the clock. It was 5 minutes. It felt like 3 years, you know. And I looked again. It was 10 minutes. I couldn't go 20 minutes without throwing back the next shot. I just couldn't do it. I didn't know why. But it talks about all these things. And we know now from reading the doctor's opinion, the reason why we can't just leave it alone or just stay away from the hard stuff or, you know, quit because of, you know, our families is because we have the physical allergy. You know, and it just kind of starts this thing, and we just can't stop. So people who aren't alcoholics and haven't necessarily studied the program don't get that, you know, but we get that. We get that. And so we can share that with other people, and people share that with me, and now I can share that with people, and it's that, you know, carrying the message thing. So they introduced this idea of, like, moderate drinkers. Don't know them. Didn't hang out with them. They weren't fun. I don't really know much about that. What I do know is I read a journal entry from when I was in college, and I'm writing about, like, the craziness of last night. Woohoo! It was crazy. And I wrote horrible H-O today, like my code for hangover, so no one would know what I was writing. I need to slow down. Moderation is the key. Right? And then I chased that for how long? That just didn't work. And then they talk about the people that could really, really drink, that really drank hard. Most of my college friends, you know, we partied hard and we did the deal. And then they graduated and went on their ways and, like, got houses and fiancés and jobs. And, like, it wasn't like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday at the bar and then go out on Saturday and Sunday, you know. It was... they weren't doing it anymore, so I guess that they were that type. And then there's, like, me, the real alcoholic. I never really started as a moderate drinker. Maybe the only moderation to my drinking was when I was young and couldn't get as much as I probably my body wanted or my soul wanted or my mind wanted. Some stage of the drinking career, I begin to lose all control of my liquor consumption once I start to drink. There it is again, the craving. Once I start to drink, I lose control. If I don't pick up that first drink, I don't lose that control. So why can't I stay away from that drink? Why can't I do that? Because I have this mental obsession that just compels me to just keep on doing that. Self-knowledge does nothing for me. It was suggested I personalize this next paragraph, 21-2, and turn the statements into questions, you know. Rachel's really puzzling you, especially in her lack of control. She does absurd, crazy, tragic things when drinking. She's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Rachel, are you seldom mildly intoxicated and always more or less insanely drunk? Well, yeah, absolutely. Does your disposition resemble your normal nature? No, it doesn't. Do you screw things up just when it's getting really important because of drinking? Yeah, I do. I really do. Couple of examples. I was going to meet friends, these college friends that had stopped, and I was kept on going, and we were supposed to meet for, like, dinner. Like, let's go to the bar, karaoke, woo! You know, and they wanted to have, like, dinner. So I decided I would prime up before going to meet them, and then next thing I know, I'm, like, looking at my watch, and I can't go meet them. There's stuff going on at the bar, you know, and I never made it. Or business trips when I couldn't make it to the trainings the next day because I was so hungover I couldn't even get out of bed. It seemed like always those moments when I really needed to be there, those were the moments I couldn't pull it together and get there. And I never planned on that, you know. It just happened when I started drinking. The bottom of that page, she uses her gifts to build up a bright outlook for her family and herself and then pulls the structure down on her head by a senseless series of sprees. I had two people in my life describe me as an enigma. Like, have you ever heard that word used to describe someone before? I had two people describe me as an enigma. One was an employer of mine, the person I was working for when I came into the rooms. The other was a guy that drank with my dad when I was a little girl, and I used to come downstairs, he'd be passed out on the couch, and then I drank with him when I was a big girl, you know, because that was where he was and where I was. I'm an enigma, and what my employer said to me was like, you're so amazing, and you're just like on fire, and you got all this stuff going on, and then something happens. I don't know what it is. He didn't know I was an alcoholic. He thought I suffered from bipolar disorder. You know, that was his diagnosis of me, but I was a drunk, and I was an enigma. And I had all these wonderful accomplishments in my life. It was one of those tools I used to deny that I had a problem. And I'd be like, you know, how come people aren't give the pat on the back? You know, I got this degree, or I did this accomplishment, or, you know, I'm a lector at church, you know, I'm a good girl. And then just this alcoholic insanity, and I would crash cars and not show up and be gone for days on end. And how can you be proud of an active alcoholic? You know, how can you be proud? They were just expecting me to screw up, and I usually did because of the booze. It goes on to talk about, you know, more of what we do, and you just read this and you just start to identify. Some of that stuff I was not yet at that place, the grabbing for the bottle in the morning. Because, no, I mean, I would do that on the weekends because I had the rule, like, you know, no drinking before, like, 5 during the week and noon on the weekends and that kind of stuff. Some of that stuff I didn't necessarily get to, but I know that it's waiting for me. All I got to do is drink again. You know, it certainly is waiting there. So they start to explain to us that we lose the power of choice. You know, we've crossed the line. We've lost the power of choice. Okay, why can't I stop drinking if I know that it gets me into trouble? You know, because there's nothing there. We don't know. We think self-knowledge, willpower, a little bit of willpower, my willpower, that'll work. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it for longer than 2 or 3 days. And it was like this, like the white knuckle thing. Like, oh, you know, I just can't. I couldn't do it for 10 hours, really. You know, I'd go to work in the morning, and I'd say, I'm not going to do that ever again. I totaled that car last night. I'm done. And by 5 o'clock, I'm looking at the clock like, I got to get out of here. You know, happy hours waiting. And there I go again. So it goes on to talk a little bit more about this mental obsession. Like, when we stay away from booze, we react like other people. You know, the authors are telling us we're pretty sure of that. And also that when we start to drink, something happens, we can't stop. We're pretty sure of that, too. We're bodily and mentally different from our fellows, as Dr. Silkworth put it. And my experience confirms that. On the top of 23, the experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. Just go back in your story, and if you're open, you probably can start to see, you know, that stuff and how that plays out. I certainly did. The mental obsession, the problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind. The mind tells my body, go ahead, you know, and then bam, I'm off and rolling. And the mind tells me, it's going to make you feel better, go ahead, you can do it. The mind makes me forget about the horror and the terror of just a couple hours before. Yeah, it's gone. It's just gone. Also, chasing that obsession. In 23:2. Someday I'll beat the game. Someday I'll be able to do it. Someday I'll be in control, you know, chasing that, like to death. So everybody around us wants us to find that day when we can just assert some control, and so do we, but like it's not going to happen if we just stay out there and try and do it on our own. So again, it talks about on page 24, we have lost the power of choice in drink. I can't choose anymore because once I pick it up, I'm done. My mind tells me drink, drink, drink. I had a car accident one night. What ended up happening was I was supposed to meet a friend. I ran my car off the road. This was about 4 months before I found my way to the rooms. And I was worried because I was supposed to meet this guy at my place, and I wasn't there. So now, like, he's going to be mad at me. And the next night, I walk into the bar. Right, my car. I have a rental car because my car's at the shop now. And I walk into the bar, and this guy walks in, and he's like, "Whoa, crazy night, man! I got pulled over by the cops. I was in the cop shop. I didn't get a DUI." And he knew people, and I knew people, and I said, "Yeah, crazy night for me too. I totaled my car. You know, it's in the shop." And oh, I was really worried you were gonna think I wasn't gonna show up. I mean, we were more worried about that. And I remember specifically, this guy said to me, "I'm just gonna have two, man. I'm just gonna have two tonight. That's it. That was crazy last night." And I'm like, I'm with you, too, and then we're out of here. You know what happened. I don't need to tell you. You know, it's 2 o'clock, last call. We're grabbing a six-pack to go. That's just the way that it happened. So, I mean, this just happened the night before. You know, we just had nothing there, without defense against the first drink. So, you know, we keep going on. The chapter keeps going on about that, you know, we think that we know we can change something or do something different and everything's going to be better, and it's just we can't do it on our own. We just can't. I couldn't do it on my own because God knows I tried. The first line on page 25, "But for the grace of God." I could have just gone on proving that stuff to myself over and over and over again, but for the grace of God, you know, I was placed in these rooms. And I've heard a lot of definitions of grace. My new favorite one is a gift when you're open to receiving it, you know, because I was definitely, like I said, placed in those positions a lot of times. But then there was that moment when I was just more open, you know, and thank God for that. There is a solution. Wow. There is? I read all the books, I've done all the therapy, I've taken all the psychotropic medications, you know, and you're telling me there's a solution in this book, you know, and the truth is there is, you know. I haven't been on medication since, you know, I was 90 days sober, and, you know, I haven't picked up many self-help books either. This is my, like, self-help book, you know. I like to read meditation books and, you know, spiritual things like that, but, you know, I didn't buy Dr. Phil's, you know, weight solution book, you know. That would have been the first thing on my list, you know, 10 years ago. So it goes on to say we saw that this really worked in others. And we came to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When we were approached with this, with people who were saying, "I solved this problem," what more could we do? All we had to do was pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. My sponsor reminds me that that's my job as a sponsor, just to show them these spiritual tools, you know, show them the steps and help them learn that stuff. We have found much of heaven and have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, which we never even dreamed. I heard these people with the Beyond My Wildest Dreams stuff, and it was like, yeah, whatever. But it's Beyond My Wildest Dreams, but not that I have a mansion and a yacht and I travel the world. Beyond My Wildest Dreams, that I have this peace and contentment and security and relationships with other people and just a love of life and others that is beyond my wildest dreams. It's really amazing. The great fact is this, and nothing less: we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. And then it points us to Appendix 2, and I'm running out of time, but that pretty much talks about you know, Bill talks about the white light thing. I didn't have the white light. Mine was of the educational type. Slowly over time, these thoughts and feelings that once existed in me were replaced with a completely new set of thoughts and feelings. The things that drove me changed into completely different things. So in my experience, I was driven by fear and insecurity and demands on people to love me. And that was replaced with a sense of peace and contentment. And the ability to love others, somewhat motive free, like sometimes that slips back a little bit, you know, but just not to place those expectations on other people. My sponsor will remind me over and over again that humans fail. You know, there is but one that can really give me everything I need, and that's my higher power. And I found God through this book and through these steps. And this chapter goes on to talk about that. People share how they found God, because that's the solution. You know, that's it. I found God through work and the steps. I just had to come to believe that there was something, and then the steps showed me the rest of that. I love the way they kind of get a little subtle about introducing God here. You know, they're talking about all the facts. And then at the end of 25, it says, we had but two alternatives. One, go on to the bitter end. Two, to find another way, seek a spiritual solution. For me, that was true even without drinking. Like, going on to the bitter end for me didn't mean necessarily drinking. It meant living the restless, irritable, discontented, problems with personal relationships, anxiety, anger. Like, I taste my disease without tasting booze. Like, that's for sure for me, you know. So I could go on to the bitter end, or I could accept spiritual help, you know. So I choose to accept spiritual help. And the chapter goes on to talk a little bit more about that mental obsession. People learning a lot about themselves. You know, Roland Hazard goes to Dr. Jung for a year, and he learns a lot about himself, but he can't get sober. And finally, the good doc tells him, it's because you're hopeless. You're absolutely hopeless. That's why you can't get better. That's why you can't stop. So that's it, you know. And then he says, no, there's a way, you know, and this is what it is, that we have these vital spiritual experiences. They appear to be in the nature of, I'm on page 27, huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. That's the miracle of the steps. That's the miracle I've experienced in my life. You know, a lot of that came with doing the fourth step, 5, 6, and 7. But I had to be really, really honest, too, and do some deep, deep searching. You know, really, really look at what the truth was. My truth might be different than yours, you know. And then they slowly move us to say this spiritual solution is God, you know, and they kind of throw it out there on page 28. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, or if you prefer, a design for living that really works. At this point, I still wasn't sure about this design for living, but the person who first read through it with me, my first sponsor, kept assuring me that it was in there. We were going to get to that, you know, and I wanted to get to that because I wanted to experience that change. I needed to, you know, it was time. I was ready. The option was to just go off to the bitter end, and I just didn't want that. I didn't come to these rooms to be miserable. I really didn't, and I craved something deeper than that, and I found it. You know, the last paragraph of the chapter just says that, you know, we hope no one takes this stuff in bad taste. We're kind of sharing some of this personal stuff. But our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need, will see these pages and believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. That happened for me as a newcomer, and you know, that's all I can do is disclose myself and my problems, share my experience, and share how I came through to the other side, you know. And that stuff still comes up, those little insecurities, the intensity of them are gone. It's gone, you know. It's amazing, and those things come up in little ways. And you know, I can call my sponsor. I did the sponsor run. I had 4 sponsors in less than 2 years, and then I finally found a sponsor that, like, I could stick with, you know, and she knows me. I've let her know me. I've shared my problems and myself, and something will kick up, and right away we can just together figure out what's this really about, you know, because I've gone through this process, and now I know, and I don't get caught up in, you know, spiraling downward. You know, I can just kind of look at it and deal with it and deal with life on life's terms, you know, but also be pretty darn happy in the process. I'm not trudging, guys. I'm not trudging the road to happy destiny. I'm kind of skipping it, you know. Sometimes I'm just strolling, you know, but when I see people trudging, I feel so bad, you know. I've just been lucky that there haven't been many horrible things that have happened to me since I came into the rooms. But there's been a lot of stuff. There's been a lot of truths revealed and a lot of emotional pain and a lot of bottoms. But I get through it pretty quick. You know, because I've been introduced to this process, and it's definitely a way that really, really works. You know, I it was seeking the truth. I found the truth underneath all that stuff that I just had to get out of, and certainly by taking away the drinking. The next couple chapters start talking more about the, you know, step one and the solution. And, you know, I just want to thank everybody for being here tonight and letting me share a little bit of what I've learned. And if you're new or coming back, I just want to say welcome home, because you don't have to go anywhere else. You know, the answers are here. And, you know, whatever it is you bring here, just share it with someone else. Share your life with another alcoholic. And if you've been here for a little while, let someone share their life with you. You know, and you share your life with another alcoholic, because it's what keeps us going. And it's what keeps us sober, and it's what I live for. So I guess that's about it.